funny, I sometimes have people, when they knew I was raised in a Jewish home and became an Adventist, you know, people say, somebody who used to be Jewish or former Jew and former Arab. But the funniest line I got just the other day, and I don't know if the dear sister's here, but it's going to be a classic line, and I'm going to remember this one for a long time, when she came up to me and she says, she knew I was, you know, Jewish home and became an Adventist. And very sweetly, she came up to me and said, she shook my hand and said, "Congratulations on becoming a Gentile." that is the best. That is the best line. That is a classic line. I mean, I have to. I'm going to use that one all from now on in all the time. That was a great line. You know, there was a time in my life when I wasn't a Gentile. There was a time in my life when I didn't even believe in God. Even though I was raised in a Jewish home, a lot of Jewish homes, you know, you don't know anything about religion. I wasn't raised religious. Nobody in my family was religious at all. Nobody even really believed in God in my home. And, you know, I never believed the Bible. I always thought the Bible was nothing but the rantings and ravings of a bunch of camel herders. I mean, they got tired of lugging these big stone idols around on their camels, so they made up this notion of some God they couldn't see, said he was one, named him Jehovah, and that was the religion of the Bible. That was all I thought it was. I never, you know, when I was raised in the kind of modern philosophical environment where it's taught you there are no absolutes, everything is relative. What's true for you might not be true for the next person. And you know, truth is all relative everywhere. And there are no absolutes. And if that's your truth, that's fine. And I grew up, this was the whole way my education was. Growing up in public school and college, everything was that way. There were no absolutes. But, you know, but I was kind of always a seeker for truth. I was always a seeker. And I remember one day I was in a pizza parlor at college and I read a statement by a philosopher. And he said, in order to live the most perfect life upon the earth, you need to find out the reason why you're here and then live your life accordingly. And after that time, I thought to myself, you know, I mean, I am here. I had to come from somewhere, and they can't, all the explanations can't be true, because some of them are entirely the opposite of each other. You know, one says God created us, another one says we're here by chance. Well, I knew that they all couldn't be true, but after that day when I was in that pizza parlor reading that philosopher, I mean, at that instant after he made that statement, in order to live the most perfect life, you got to find out the reason why you're here and then live accordingly. From that moment on, I thought to myself, if it is humanly possible to know truth, and by truth, I mean, what is the purpose of our life? Is there a God? What are we here for? Where do we come from? You know, these basic questions. I thought to myself, if I can know truth, I wanted to know it. I don't care what it cost me, where it led me, what I had to suffer, but I don't care what. If I could get the answer to these questions, I want to know them no matter what. And all I know is that of all the different philosophies, and I delved into a lot of the different philosophies, delved and read these philosophers, of all the different gurus in Eastern religions, you know, these gurus would come to the town where I was in and I would, you know, go hang out with the people that follow the gurus. I mean, of all the, you know, the Marxists were around. I used to read Marxist stuff. Of all the different ways, of all the different philosophies, views, ad infinitum, on and on. I mean, I was open to anything. Of all the different ways I could have gone, I ended up becoming a Seventh-day Adventist. You know, and it's remarkable for a number of reasons. I mean, one of the reasons is that, you know, in my life I used to hate two kinds of people. I used to hate Christians, and I used to hate, and I'm serious, vegetarians. I'm serious. I mean, I'm serious. I was so carnivorous. I was so into eating meat that when I would meet vegetarians, I mean, I would laugh at them. I would insult them right to their faces for years. When I would meet vegetarians, I mean, I would just laugh in their faces. When I first met my Adventist friends, I just insulted them and laughed at them for being vegetarians. I was so into eating meat that, I just thought you had to be an idiot to be a vegetarian. And every vegetarian I met, I let them know that's what I thought. Well, anyway, my animosity towards Christianity, though, was a little more deep-seated. You know, even though I wasn't raised in a Jewish home, I was raised, though, with a keen sense of being a Jew. And I would, you know, and a keen sense of Jewish history. And I grew up just bitter against Christianity for what it's done to the Jews over the centuries. You know, I don't know how many of you are even aware of what the church has done to the Jews through the centuries. You know, when I give seminars on how to witness to Jews, sometimes I say, do you ever wonder why Jewish people are sometimes hard to reach with Jesus? And then I'll spend 15 minutes and I'll just read to them one list of atrocities after another. I mean, I can go down the road. The Crusaders would go into the Holy Land in 1099, round up all the Jews, put them in the local synagogue and burn it to the ground while they sang hymns to Jesus. All the way through Europe, crowds led by a priest would come to Jewish homes and confiscate all their property and tell the Jews, if you don't convert, we're going to burn you at the stake. And they wouldn't convert, so they'd burn them at the stake. So whole communities of Jews were just wiped out at the instigation of the church. I mean, time and time again, all through history. I mean, I could go on and on and on and just read you continually what has happened to the Jews in the name of Christ. I mean, unless you've studied history, study a little about that, you're not going to be aware of it. But maybe, you know, if you have a Jewish friend sometime, you'd like to get an idea of where they're coming from, get a book on Jewish history and just study what the church through the centuries had done to the Jews, or, you know, in the name of Christ, in the name of religion. Well, I was bitter. I was bitter over that. And I used to take out my animosity on this preacher. When I went to the University of Florida at Gainesville. That's where I went to college. And there used to be one of these hellfire and brimstone preachers used to come to the campus. I mean, this guy was a preacher. This guy had a voice like you never hear before. He didn't need a microphone. But he'd be out there and he'd be hollering, you know, bringing down damnation and damning the queers and this and that and so on the campus and the infidels and be preaching. We have his Bible in his hand, and he would draw a crowd. He would draw pretty good crowds on the campus. I mean, the University of Florida was a very liberal campus. I mean, they'd have officially recognized homosexual clubs. I mean, they would be allowed to use the campus facilities and so forth. I mean, it was very liberal environment. This guy would come there with his Bible, and he'd be preaching about the gospel, you know, and eternal damnation and eternal hellfire, and he would draw a crowd of maybe 100, 150 people would get around him, and he'd be in the center of the circle, and he'd be preaching to everyone, and there'd be people taunting him from the crowd and heckling him and so forth. Well, I was never content to stand in the circle with the crowd. Instead, I used to get in the center of that circle. I used to get on that preacher's heels, and I would literally spit in his face, and I would curse him, and I would curse God, and I would curse his mother, and I would, everything he'd say, I would curse and condemn and use foul language, and I used to get him so mad, he swore to me there was no hope for me. If he damned me to hell once, he damned me to hell 1,000 times. He says, I've seen plenty of miserable reprobates in my time, but you are the worst sinner. You're going to burn in hell forever, you know, and so on. This went on. I mean, we went back and forth. I mean, he used to put his hands on me and speak in tongues and try to cast demons out of me. And I would writhe on the ground as if I was being exorcised of demons. And I mean, it was a show. It was a show in front of this guy. I mean, and this went on year after year, every time this guy would come to the campus. I mean, it was just axiomatic. I would be in the center of the crowd right on his heels, I mean, harassing him, and just, I mean, I made life, you know, as miserable for him as I could. I mean, I got really, sometimes I got downright obscene and crude with this guy. And this went on eventually. I mean, I became known for that. And I'd be in a bar somewhere and somebody would come up to me and shake my hand and congratulate me on what a great job I was doing to the preacher. And I mean, eventually my friends nicknamed me Heckle. That was my nickname, Heckle. My friends knew me as Heckle. I mean, I was known for that on the campus. Well, anyway, this was just my way. This was just my way of trying to vent my anger. At least that's what I thought it was. I think there was a little bit more complicated than that. I really believe I was fighting conviction, but that's another story. Well, anyway, this went on until I graduated college back in, I can't remember, I keep telling this, it's not like 78 or something. I graduated college at the University of Florida, and at that point, I had only one goal in my life, only one real desire in my life. I was going to write novels. Ever since I was a little kid, I knew that I was going to be a novelist, was going to write novels. I've got novelists in my family. I've got writers in my family that go back generations, journalists, editors, and whatnot. I said, hey, I'm going to be a novelist. Now, my last year at college, or next to my last year, I started a novel. And pretty soon this novel became my life. Before long, I mean, I was so into writing. It was all I lived for, was writing. And I started working on this novel. And before long, this novel just consumed me. I mean, I poured everything into writing this book. Now, you know, I finished school because my parents wanted me to finish school. I knew I had to finish school, but I didn't really care. All I cared about was working on my novel. I mean, I was going for broke with this. When a lot of my friends were going on to graduate school or going to become doctors or lawyers, accountants, whatever, I mean, I was pouring everything, either make it or break it, on this novel. Well, I finished college and I went back to Miami Beach. That's where I grew up. Grew up in Miami Beach. And I stayed home a little while and then I decided I'm going to go over to Europe and work on the novel in Europe because I had some money left over from school. And I had been to Europe numerous times, liked it over there. And part of the novel took place in Europe. So I figured I was going to go to the area, you know, eventually where then part of the novel took place. So I flew over to Europe and I wound up in England. And I wound up just hitchhiking around there a while, looking for a place where I could live and write. And believe it or not, at one point I wound up living in a Catholic monastery off the coast of Wales, on an island off the coast of Wales. And I thought, well, at least I can get work on my book here because I'm on an island with a bunch of monks. I'm not going to have too many distractions. But anyway, I was there about 1 week and the monks threw me out. So that took care of that. So I didn't know what to do, but I knew I wanted to get working on my novel. Now, I had a friend that I knew that lived in Athens. I knew him at school. So I thought, I'm going to hitchhike down to Greece. Took a boat over from England to Holland, and then I just hitchhiked all the way across Europe. I mean, that's a long haul, especially when you get to Yugoslavia. I mean, that's a long haul. The main highway is one road. You know, one going one way, one going the other way. I mean, I could have walked through the country about the length of time it took me to get a ride. But eventually I get all the way through. I hitchhike, it takes me days and days, and I get all the way to Athens. You know, and then Athens is a big jungle, and I get the address, and I take the subway, and I go traipsing through the city streets, and I finally come to the house of this guy. And I knock on the door, his mother comes out, I tell her who I am, she says, I'm sorry, but my son is not here, he is in Miami. So I thought, oh well. Well anyway, I didn't know what to do, so I went to sleep. I went, took my sleeping bag, I went over to a park, and I lay down to go to sleep in the park, just down the block from where she lived. And that night I had a dream. And in the dream, I dreamt that I went to Israel to live on a kibbutz and write the novel on a kibbutz. Does anybody here not know what a kibbutz is? You know, a kibbutz is kind of like a little self-supporting farming community. You know, it's like the self-enclosed unit. Everybody lives together. You know, you could spend 1 year, you're the head of the kibbutz. The next year, you're in the kitchen doing the dishes, the next year you're a farmer. In other words, everybody kind of shared the job. It was an attempt at making an equal society. And the way they had it worked out is you can go there as a volunteer. You work 6 hours a day or whatever, 5 days a week, and then the rest of the time is yours. So I had this dream that I was going to go to a kibbutz. And I woke up in the morning and I thought, look, I've been in Europe now a month. You're traipsing around. You want to get writing on your novel. Follow your dream. Follow the dream. So, I mean, that evening I had a dream that I went to Israel. That afternoon, literally, I was on a plane, flew to Israel, went to the kibbutz office, got assigned to a kibbutz way up in the north. And I said, look, I was always an adventuresome type. So I said, I want a kibbutz. Give me a kibbutz near the Syrian border. So I got to this kibbutz way up, right along the edge of the Golan Heights. And I mean, this area, I mean, you would work in the fields and we would be right next to the Golan and, you know, I'd be working in the fields. Hey, thanks a lot. Great, great. There you go. Syria. Here we are, right next to Syria. Yeah. There we go. So, but it would be interesting because there would be, you know, I'd be working in the fields and sometimes the Golan in the summer would burn because it was a hot summer and I'd be working in the fields and I'd hear these explosions and I'd look up and maybe 300 yards from me were the landmines that the army had left there. You know, it would just catch on fire and explode. So, I mean, it was kind of an exciting area, quote unquote, to live in. Well, anyway, I went up to this kibbutz way up right along the edge of the Golan Heights. And I'm going to work on my novel up here. Well, I'm there about 1 week, and who should show up but a group of these 12 religious Christians from America. Come to the kibbutz, to live on the kibbutz for a year. Well, here I am, I was furious. So here I am in the one Jewish state in the world. And they're going to have these group of these Christians here. Well, I started to lay into these people. I mean, I had years of practice from harassing that preacher on the campus. I mean, these people were my prime target, fundamentalist Christians. Because that's what that preacher was. So I started laying into them, harassing them. You know, I had years of dirty jokes and insults that I had from the preacher. Well, eventually the Jews on the kibbutz told me, hey, if you don't leave this guy alone, leave these people alone, we're going to kick you out of here. Because they were very good workers. You know, they came there to be like a silent witness. And they were very good workers. And I didn't get along with a lot of the Israelis anyway. So they told me, either you leave them alone or we're going to throw you out. And I got thrown out of that monastery already. And I don't want to get thrown out of here as well because I wanted to write on my book. So anyway, I just left them alone and just went about and, you know, I mean, you'd work 5-6 hours a day, 6 days a week, and then the rest of the time was yours. They cooked all your meals for you. Your clothes were washed for you. So I had lots of spare time. So I spent the time just writing my novel. And, you know, I had a girlfriend from Scandinavia on the kibbutz. And I mean, I really had a great time there. I don't want to do anything to mess it up. Well, one day, somebody shows up on the kibbutz. Part of the Christian group. He was a Jew who became a believer in Jesus. Now, if there's anything in the world that I hated more than a serious Christian, was a Jew who became one. Well, I really laid into this guy. I started giving him the usual line, oh, you're a mishumud, a traitor. And I started giving him all the lines. But, you know, this guy was different. First of all, he was very, very intelligent. And I just never could put the two together. I could not see how anybody really, really intelligent could believe in the Bible. Because I told you, I thought it was just a bunch of myths by a bunch of camel herders they put together. But here's this guy, very intelligent fella. And I used to ask him all these trick questions, you know, can God create a rock so big that he can't lift, you know, and these kind of brilliant, brilliant arguments that I would try to throw up at these people. But this guy used to give me some of the most simple and clearest answers. You know, he used to really blow my mind at times. And I used to think, boy, that makes sense. You know, I mean, I couldn't write the guy off as some kind of kook. Because I thought these people, they had too many bad acid trips, or they had psychological problems or something. But he was a very down-to-earth, rational, intelligent fella. And I couldn't, you know, it was real easy to write all the other ones of them off. But I couldn't be honest and write this fellow off like that. And I remember one day on the kibbutz, they had a Purim party. Now in Israel, in Judaism, Purim is a real pagan bash. Anything goes. And they had a real wild party on the kibbutz that night. And none of the Christians went to the party. And so the next day I saw this guy, Ephraim, and I said, "Why didn't you people go to the party?" And he looked me right in the eyes, and he said, "We prayed to the Lord all week, and he told us not to go." And I can remember just going back to my room and almost just banging my head against the wall, because I couldn't write the guy off as a kook. You know, I was always an honest seeker for truth. As I told you, I wanted to know truth no matter what. And I couldn't write the guy off. I didn't really believe for one minute that Jesus, that God is going to tell these people not to go to the Purim party. But then again, at the same time, I thought, the guy isn't a nut. The guy doesn't have hallucinations. I mean, was God really talking to them? I thought, if God really is there and he really does talk to people, well, I want him to talk to me. You know, I wanted to know. Well, anyway, this guy made an impression. I didn't really know what to do, but he got me really thinking, and really inside I had this burning desire. I said, "Hey, I wish I could know for sure one way or the other." Well, after about 1 year goes by, I leave Israel and I hitchhike back up to Europe. I'm going to go up to Scandinavia, to Denmark, because a good part of my novel took place in Denmark. So I leave the kibbutz, fly to Greece, and then just hitchhike all the way back up the exact opposite direction I came in a year before. I hitchhike up and I went up to Scandinavia, to live in Scandinavia, in Denmark. And I had been on the road a lot, and I was real seasoned as a traveler in Europe, hitchhiking through Europe. But this trip, I had an awful lot of hassles, an awful lot of problems. And I mean, at one place, the one area where I wanted to live in, I ended up getting in a fight with the guy who pulled a knife on me, and the cops took him away. But then they let the guy go like 2 hours later because the knife wasn't long enough. And they had to let the guy go. And so the whole time I'm in this little like hippie community, I'm looking over my shoulder. I just know this guy was a drug addict. I know that guy's just going to get revenge on me. You know, so I'm always looking over my shoulder there, and I was very depressed about that. And then I went to visit a friend who I had met under such wild, almost unbelievable circumstances a few years earlier. I don't have time to go into that now, but I stayed with him for a while. Now, this man was deep, deep, deep into spiritualism and the occult. You know, I mean, back then I didn't know spiritualism and the occult. I didn't believe God, the supernatural. I didn't believe in any of that stuff. But I remember one day in his apartment, I mean, it was such weird things were going on in that guy's apartment. And, you know, and I just started getting the creeps, even though I didn't believe in anything supernatural. I remember at one point this guy looked me right in the face. He was really suffering. He looked at me and he said, 20 years ago I asked for Jesus. He said, instead I got the devil. And, you know, and I didn't know anything about Jesus or the devil back then. All I knew was, hey, I'm getting out of here. You know, I mean, this was just bizarre. So I ended up, you know, here was a guy that I really cared about and wanted to stay with, but I ended up leaving there. And I ended up leaving Scandinavia after a while, and I went down to Paris and was just living in Paris, and I was trying to get a place to stay to work on my novel, and I was really depressed, really having a lot of problems. But I said to myself, I said, there's no way in the world that I'm going to accept a religion or I'm going to accept a belief just because makes me feel better. I said, I would rather be here, be miserable, live without any hope, then believe a false hope. I said, God, if you really exist, if you really are there, you are going to have to reveal yourself to me. Because I said, I don't care how, I said, I'd rather commit suicide than purposely accept a lie, something which I know is not true, but just accept it because it makes me feel better. As I said, I wanted truth. I wasn't looking for something to kill the pain. So it would have been nice. I said, I wanted to. I said, I'm not going to believe. I said, God, if you're there, you must reveal yourself to me. In other words, forget it. I will not follow. I will not believe. And that was my mind frame at the time. Well, I ended up, after a while, leaving Paris, and I ended up just going back to Israel, hitchhiking back down again. Well, this time I went through Italy. went to Italy, and I ended up going back to Israel. And I went back to my old kibbutz, and they wouldn't let me back on. They wouldn't let me back on. So I said, all right, fine. I wanted to get assigned to another kibbutz and continue to work on my novel. So I go to the kibbutz office in Tel Aviv, and I'm in the kibbutz office, and there's a woman at the desk, and there's a fella in front of her, and he's getting assigned to a kibbutz, and I'm just sitting there. And I happen to glance over and look on the desk, and I see a sheet of paper on the desk. And it has my name on it. It says Clifford Goldstein. So I thought, So the woman's talking to this fella. And I thought, well, that's strange. So I just interrupted, and I said, hey, excuse me. I said, how did you know I was coming here? And the woman said, well, you know, I didn't know you were coming here. Who are you? And I said, well, my name is Clifford Goldstein. Well, the boy in front of me, he turns around and looks at me and he says, no, he says, my name is Clifford Goldstein. And that's what the sheet of paper was for him. So, you know, I mean, we laughed a little bit. I mean, Goldstein, Israel, you know, I mean, that's the most Jewish name in the world, really. You know, so we, you know, it was kind of funny to meet, to run into someone with the same name. So we just chit-chatted for a minute. And then just out of the blue, I said, hey, Cliff, where are you from? And he said, I'm from Miami Beach. And I said, well, I come from Miami Beach. So again, we just, you know, this is when I'm asking God for signs. But anyway, we're just warming up. And I said, and, you know, again, we laughed, you know, from Miami. But you think about it, Goldstein, Israel, Miami Beach. You know, most of the Jews that aren't in Israel, they're in Miami Beach or they're in New York. So we chatted for a few minutes, and he wanted to get assigned to a kibbutz. So I said, Cliff, have I got the kibbutz for you? And I said, you go to my old kibbutz, and you tell him your name is Clifford Goldstein, and that you come from Miami Beach. So he went. So he went to the kibbutz. Well, a couple weeks later, and I'm going through these heavy struggles. I'm saying, God, if you're there, you've got to reveal yourself to me. And I'm, you know, seeking for signs. Well, about a couple weeks later, I come to the kibbutz for a visit. And of all the different rooms that were on the kibbutz, Clifford Goldstein was in my old room. Now, they didn't put him there because I had been there. That was just the only vacant room that happened to have been vacant, because I was gone for months before I met him. He was in my old room, and there were a couple beds in there, and he was sleeping in my old bed. So again, you know, we just kind of laughed about it. We didn't think that much of it. You know, it was kind of uncanny. But then is when everything started to get really hairy. When I was in the kibbutz, I said I was working on this novel. I mean, this novel was my life. And besides, when I wasn't writing, I did a lot of reading. I mean, I wouldn't have been worth a nickel as a writer if I didn't read. And I had lots of books there, and I read lots of poetry books. At that time of my life, I was into a poetry kick. And when I had left Israel to go up to the Scandinavia, I left all my books, just grabbed one or two that I hadn't read. You know, I'd buy them and sell them on the road. You know, you meet people on the road, always ready to change books. And I left all my books on the bookshelf, right over the bed. And I'm talking to Clifford Goldstein, and I look up there, and I see a number of my old books right on the bookshelf. And so, because of where I had left them. And I said, oh, Cliff, you like my books? And then I'll never forget his exact words. He looks at me and he says, no, he says, those are all my books. And I'll never forget, there was one book of poetry by a woman named Sylvia Plath. I mean, this book of poetry had devastated me. I mean, this was heavy poetry. That book had affected me more profoundly than anything I had read the whole year. I mean, the last poem in the book, she gave her children cookies and milk, went down, wrote this poem, and then stuck her head in an oven and gassed herself. So, I mean, it was a heavy, heavy stuff, you know? But there was the book. There was my book. And I reached up and I pulled that book. Because no book I had read the whole year had hit me like this book of poetry. And I pulled the book of poetry off the shelf, and I looked through it. Same author, same edition, same title, same everything. But it was not my book. It was his book. And then I turned around and out of the blue, I don't know why I said it, but I looked at Clifford Goldstein and I said, Cliff, are you a writer? And he says, yes, I'm a writer. I've come to Israel to write. Now, this is exactly what happened. I know when I start getting this far, I start getting the funny looks from the people. We're not done yet. Okay? I mean, I don't know what to make of this. And then, to top it off, when I was on the kibbutz, I had a tall, blonde, Danish girlfriend. Her name was Tina. Clifford Goldstein introduced me to his girlfriend. She was tall, she was blonde, she was from Denmark, and he said, Cliff, you'll never guess what her name is. And I said, don't tell me. Her name was Tina. It wasn't the same girl, but still, I mean, this is exactly what happened. Well, I'm just sitting there thinking, what is going on around here? And I remember I walked down to those Christians on the kibbutz. And one of them, I'll never forget, one of them looked me right in the face. Because everyone was seeing this happening on the kibbutz. I mean, everybody on the kibbutz was going, they couldn't believe it. But if they couldn't believe it, how do you think I felt about it? And then one of the Christians on the kibbutz, he looked at me right in the face and he said, Cliff, he says, what more do you want? He said, you're asking for signs. He said, God is calling you by name. By name. Well, you know, I can't describe exactly the experience or what I felt. But I remember right after my friend said that, I remember I stepped outside and I looked up at the sky. And it didn't look the same. It was like as if a veil was torn away from my eyes. And I looked up and I knew that was not a coincidence. I mean, I knew there was some kind of divine hand or something did that. Because there was just no way all those things could have fit together. Especially at a time when I'm looking for signs. Well, anyway, I didn't know what to make of it all, but the next day, those Christians whom I harassed and bothered for that whole time, they took me down to the Jordan River and they baptized me. Okay? And I came back to America, but there was only one small problem. I mean, I wasn't converted. My life hadn't changed. You know, I mean, that was a heavy experience meeting my double. You know, and they gave me a Bible, and I would read through the Bible a little bit, but I was no more born again than a corpse. Nothing really changed in my life. I came back, and I only had one goal, writing that novel. I came back to the States. I went back to Gainesville, Florida. I got myself a little room in the student ghetto where I was at and went back to working on the novel. I got myself a job driving an ice cream truck like 2 days a week. I mean, I had almost no money. All I wanted was enough money just to survive so I could work on the novel. Now, I'm going to backtrack, and then I'm going to come back. After I left my friend in Denmark, I was back on the kibbutz in Israel, and I lay down one morning to take a little nap. And I got this strange little tingling in my toes. And it rolled up, so I felt this loud vibration and this loud pounding in my head, and I had the sensation I was going through a wind tunnel. And I sat up, shaking, thought, what's going on? And a couple days later, vibration, this pounding, the sensation of going through a wind tunnel. And it kept on occurring. And each time I would sit up, scared to death, I thought, what is happening to me? And then one afternoon, after I was back in the States, I lay down to take a little nap. The tingling in my toes, the loud tingling, the vibration, it would roll up. I get this loud pounding in my head, and then all of a sudden, zoosh! I went right out of my body. I remember seeing the ceiling, going right past the ceiling, seeing the beams underneath the roof, going right out of the roof, going right out, right down the street, hovering outside an apartment of these two guys I knew who were into a guru. Now, before I go any further, understand I'm a hardcore SDA. I understand body-soul relationships now. But back then, I knew nothing about that. And nothing in the world, anything you would ever could have told me, could have convinced me that that was not my immortal soul. That was not my soul leaving my body and going outside. And it was interesting that I would go outside the room of these two guys who were telling me all about their guru, and they were trying to get me interested in their guru. They lived right down the street. But I remember it was such a frightening experience that I instantly came right back in my body and I sat up and said, wow, boy, that's new. And then this started happening to me more and more. And then I decided one day, hey, you know, I was baptized in the Jordan River, had a Bible looked at, but my life hasn't changed. But this spiritualism, this stuff is real. This is real. I mean, up until then, I still had questions all the time about the supernatural and all that. But man, one or two trips like that, and I knew my life was never going to be the same again, because I know I had stepped in a whole other dimension of existence. So I decided, hey, I'm going to go study spiritualism. So I'm walking down the street to the library to get a book on spiritualism. And on the way over, there's this health food store. And I just happened to stop at the health food store for 1 minute to ask the guy a question. And the store was closed. And the guy comes out of the health food store. And I mentioned him something about religion. Well, the next thing I know, he just yanks me in the store. Closes the door, because he was trying to sell the health food store, and we start talking. And I start telling him what I'm into, and he starts to warn me about what I'm getting into. And I just laughed him off. Oh, yeah, you know, you believe in Santa Claus and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, because he starts telling about the devil and all that. And I laughed him off. But anyway, he hands me a book and says, read this book. So I walk out of the health food store and I go over to the library and I get a book on spiritualism. And I sit there in the library and I start reading the spiritualism book, and I even start practicing the first technique right in the library. I couldn't check the book out because I wasn't in school then. I started practicing the first technique. Well, anyway, to make a long story short, I'm walking through the library and literally, for the first time in my life, in one hand, I have a book on spiritualism. And then literally, in my other hand, for the first time in my life, I have the book the guy handed me in the health food store. I got it in my hand at the same time. Which book do you think it was? The Great Controversy. I've got one book in one hand, one book in the other hand, and I had no idea. I had no idea what was happening to me then. Well, anyway, I read a few chapters out of the Great Controversy. Didn't get that far into it. Well, about two nights later, I'm sitting in my room. It's 7 o'clock in the evening. The book was going better. The novel was going better than it had ever gone in the 2.5 years that I put in. It was my life. And that, you know, if anybody come in and threatened to have torn a page of that book, it would have been their life or mine. I mean, and that up to that night, I still didn't even know that God existed. I still didn't know what was going on. And then that night, out of the blue, I mean, I had no conception a minute before what was going to happen to me. And that night, out of the blue, the Spirit of the Lord Jesus Christ came to me. I mean, up to that point, I didn't even believe in Jesus. But out of the blue, and I knew exactly what it was and what was happening, the Lord came to me and said, Cliff, you have been playing with me long enough. If you want me tonight, burn the novel. Now, it's not that the novel was evil. It's not that the novel in and of itself was evil. It was my relationship. That novel was my God. I was ready to forsake anybody, anything, everything for God and for truth, but not that book. And I said, God, please, let me just finish this book, and then I'll give my life to you. But it was no if. See, God always leaves us a choice. He said, if you want me tonight, burn the novel. And because I could have, at that moment, I could have just said, go away and leave me alone. He left me my choice. And I said, please, God, let me finish it, and then I'll give my life to you. But it was, no, if you want me, burn the book. They said, look, I'll rewrite it all to your glory. It was, no, if you want me tonight, burn the novel. Again, it was if. It was always my choice. I said, okay, God, look, let me just put it away. We could talk about it another time. But it was, no, if you want me tonight, burn the novel. Well, there was no way in the world I would be able to burn that book. That was all that I had in the world, literally. So I remember I just went outside. I just went outside sobbing. And I got sick. I was so upset. So what do? I didn't know anything about the health methods. I went over to Dunkin' Donuts and had donuts and coffee. Calm my nerves. And then I just paced the streets. And I just walked the streets. It was after dark now. And I walked the streets and I said to myself for years, I said, I wanted to know truth, no matter what it was going to cost me. And that night I knew really what it was going to cost me. And I just finally at one point I said, okay, God, okay, Jesus, I want you. I want truth more than I want this book. But I don't have it in me to burn it. I can't burn it. If you want this book burned, you're going to have to burn it for me. Then at that moment, I was just suddenly overwhelmed with a feeling of peace and joy and having no conception at all of really what I was getting. I didn't know anything about the truths that we have, about the atonement, about the cross. I didn't know anything about anything. I went home that night, totally under the unction of the Holy Spirit, went in my room, took that manuscript. 2.5 years work, literally all I had left in the world. I just laid it on that hot plate, turned on the hot plate, and burned it. And that was the night that I was truly converted. You know, and up to 3 times a week, I was having those occult experiences. But once I burned that novel, once I gave myself totally to Jesus, the devil was never able to come back in again and to use those occult experiences to deceive me. You know, I believe from my being dealing with that guy in Scandinavia that somehow the devil had an open door on me. He got into me and he saw that I was seeking spiritual things and he gave me spiritual things. But he overplayed his hand on me. You know, and to this day, hey, when we talk about the supernatural and this and that, we're not talking poetry, philosophy, or theology. I mean, we're dealing with reality. But once I burned that book and made that total commitment to Jesus, never happened again. Those experiences never came back. And after that, I met the Adventists in the health food store, and I've only got just a few minutes left. I started studying with them, and 6 months went by. And I had no idea what ever happened to Clifford Goldstein. He had no idea what happened to me. I didn't even know he left the Middle East. I was standing in front of that health food store. 2 seconds would have gone by. It would have been too late. But who drives by in a car? Clifford Goldstein. I didn't know he even left Israel. He didn't know that where I was, Gainesville, 6-hour ride from Miami. Another 2 seconds I would have missed him. I see him drive by in a car. He sees me. The brakes screech. He gets out of the car and we talk. At that point I knew what was going on. And even that preacher that I harassed, year after year, he came back. He came back to town. And I stood right next to him, right on his heels, as I had done for years. Only now, this time, instead of spitting on him and cursing him, I preached to people in the audience. And they remembered me. They remembered me from as before. You know, and in the closing moments, I usually have some scripture text that I read, but it's running later. You know, when I burned that book that night, I realized I might not ever write again. But I knew that, hey, God wants the whole heart. You know, the Spirit convicted me of that night. Hey, you got to either go all the way with me or forget it. And when I burned that book, that was literally all that I had in the world. I realized I might not ever, ever write again. And yet, I said, okay. And I burned the book. And for about 2 years, I didn't do any writing at all. And then about 6 years ago, the Lord opened the door up for me to start writing again. And you know, and that's all I've been doing for 6-7 years now is writing. So the Lord gave it back. Well, you know, there's a lot more to go into this. But as I said, I wanted to know truth no matter what it cost me. It cost me everything, and here I am, a Seventh-day Adventist. And I realize in the end, maybe down the road someday to end up keeping this truth and to staying in this truth, I'm going to have to burn burn more books. You know, every day my prayer to the Lord has been, Lord, I want to burn another book. It's got nothing to do with salvation by works, but it's got everything to do with an inward desire to yield myself totally and completely and 100% to Jesus Christ. And if there's anything at all in the way, simply to burn it. And so if there's a moral of the story, if you have any books in your life, if there's anything at all, and you know in your heart, what it is. Nobody could have told me I had to burn that book. It was only between me and the Lord. I mean, choose to burn it. Ask God, say, Lord, I want you more than that. And if it's hard to give up, if you don't feel like you can do it, the Lord will give you the strength to get rid of, to burn it, to get rid of it, or to burn it, or to do whatever. I mean, what else matters? You know, I consider it no small thing, as I said the other day, to be a member of this church. And I feel I have a divine call in my life. And it's got nothing to do with having such a wacko conversion experience. I believe just being a Seventh-day Adventist and knowing the things that we know, having the light that God has poured upon us like no people have ever had since the beginning of the world, just knowing that, to me, that is a divine call. And but the only way God can use us is if we, through one way or another, we burn the books that are in our lives. Shall we pray? Lord God in heaven, I'm just so thankful. Just so, you know, from the depths of my heart, how thankful I am to have been called out of what I was called out of and brought into this message, into this truth. And Lord, I know in so many ways I fail you so miserably. In many ways, I feel as if my whole life is a spiritual failure. And yet, Lord, I know that Jesus' whole life was a spiritual success. From the moment He was born until the moment He died on that cross, Jesus was a spiritual success. And He has succeeded where I have failed and where many of us have failed. And Lord, I just claim His successes in my behalf. And Lord, not only want them imparted to me, but I want those successes imputed to me so that I too can have the same successes that He had had. And Lord, I just thank You for knowing the truths that we know. And Lord, help me never to take it lightly. Help me never to just become acclimated to it and accustomed to these truths and used to it. But Lord, may the wonderment, may the wonder that I felt those first few years as this truth unfolded to me, may that wonder that I felt, may I continue to feel that. And may everyone here continue to feel the wonderment of the great truths that we have been given. And may we continue to have that love of the truth that Paul talked about. Lord, this is my prayer in the name of Jesus. Amen.
You've been listening to Clifford Goldstein, editor of Shabbat Shalom, the church's enthusiastic outreach magazine to the Jews. International copyright 1988, American Cassette Ministries, all rights reserved. Duplication or transcription in any form is prohibited. For additional copies of this cassette, please write to American Cassette Ministries, Post Office Box 922, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, 17108. If you have received a special blessing from this cassette, please tell a friend about your friend, American Cassette Ministries. We're a nonprofit corporation helping prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ.